Last night, my 12-year-old son was mixing up a batch of fake blood for his zombie Justin Bieber costume. Hey, all his idea. But the notion that blood fascinates us, inflames us, defines us is a very old one, of course, and central to our notions of self and tribe. Novelist Lawrence Hill takes a deep dive under the skin to explore our myths about the stuff of life that courses through our arteries and veins. Blood, the Stuff of Life, is his book, and it begins with the gory story of a little kid seeing his own blood for the very first time.
One time I cut my wrist playing as a child in a schoolyard and ran up the street intentionally bleeding on every sidewalk panel for the 200 yards between the site of the accident and my mother's house, because even though I was terrified and losing lots of blood, I wanted to make sure that I marked every sidewalk panel with an unbroken string of blood. Why would an 8-year-old think to do such a thing? I think it's because I sensed deep inside that this was something sacred and special spilling out of me, and I should therefore use it to mark the occasion. Who wants to waste their own blood?
And then you had a much more serious encounter with a glass window pane that caused you to actually see inside of yourself. Part of the story here in this book is just how much blood reveals, but also how little blood reveals of what we think it is. Our mythology is great when it comes to blood.
It sure is. And really, there's no other bodily part or fluid or substance that sort of seduces us and holds us in this thrall the way blood does. We don't spend hours or centuries fixating on our saliva or on our livers, but blood is something really, really special to us, and blood is the one part of us that feeds into our own sense of identity. I think in a way, in the West, it dates back to thousands of years of thinking about the body being divided into four humors, you know, black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood. And the idea is that personality can be ascribed to the balance between these humors in the body. And this really dominated human thinking in the West for thousands of years.
In the history that you describe here, and it is really fascinating because our notion of the way blood is today doesn't even begin to resemble what it was hundreds of years ago. And we grasped onto blood as humans in the beginning because it seemed so simple.
It sure isn't simple. And the ideas we've had, like that one of the very first transfusions on record or attempted transfusions is a French physician who grabs a psychotic man off the streets of Paris in 1667 and forcibly transfuses into this psychotic man the blood of a calf, because the physician believes that the tranquil essence of the calf's personality will somehow enter the veins of this patient and rid him of his problems. Well, it rids him of his problems, all right. It rids him of his life and kills him, because of course you can't take an animal's blood in your veins. So these things aren't simple at all. Even the issue of transfusion took a long time before we really came to understand, finally around 1901, that what matters is you match blood types in order to have a safe transfusion from human to human. But as blood moves from a bodily substance, a medical and scientific property, to one of metaphor and personality, it becomes more and more complex.
The story of race is in our understanding of blood. The story of gender is in our understanding of blood. Why, and how did you sort of rediscover that in the investigations for this book?
Well, it's really incredible to think of blood as a divider between men and women. And I would say that for thousands of years, men have come to imagine blood to be a trophy of sport or war, or perhaps a byproduct of accident, if, say, somebody hurt or shot or stabs you. But for women, of course, if they're of childbearing age, blood is a sign of their fertility, is a sign of their health. They should be bleeding monthly unless they're pregnant. And so blood is something that a woman's going to encounter on a monthly basis. And I think men and women have profoundly different responses to it. And men for thousands of years have misinterpreted in spectacular ways women's blood and women's bleeding. And I think this has led in many ways to many of the ways in which women have suffered discrimination on the job, you know, in the military, etc. So blood and gender is huge. But blood and race is also huge. And nowhere is this more extreme than in North America, where we have this idea that you can boil down a person's race to blood parts, and laws and court decisions are made based on trying to find numbers to attribute race to blood parts in Canada and in the United States. It's a process that is in some ways ongoing.
I'm wondering, as a dad of five kids. You and I share that. What do you think when you see the blood of your own kids in the course of their growing up?
I have five children, and my wife and I married, and I brought three children from a previous marriage into the equation, and Miranda brought two children from her previous marriage into our new house. And my father was an African American, and my mother was a white American who moved to Canada. My wife is white, and her daughter, Beatrice, is white. And one day when Beatrice was about five, she spoke to my wife. She'd been in my life already for two or so years, and she said, "Well, Mommy, I'm a little bit black too, right?" And Miranda said, "Well, what do you mean, Beatrice?" And Beatrice said, "Well, Larry's black, and he's my stepfather, so that makes me a little bit black too." And this put my wife in a very interesting and delicate position of trying to explain to Beatrice that, you know, race isn't generally seen that way, and one generally imagines that race derives from biological or family ancestry. But really, who's to say that Beatrice couldn't acquire a different identity? Thousands of people have changed their identity, perhaps people who convert to Judaism, perhaps people who slide in passing from calling themselves black to calling themselves white. There are all sorts of people who've played with and toyed with their own identities, even permanently. Why should Beatrice be denied the idea of thinking of herself as black if she wants to? And it was a very touching and interesting encounter with a five-year-old, and it really cast us back to notions of blood and identity, and we had to think through it to talk to her.
And it's the blood that keeps our mind going and
it sure is.
Allows us to have this license, but the blood doesn't care. It's just keeping us alive.
The blood doesn't care, but we do.
Lawrence Hill, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Lawrence Hill is the author of Blood, the Stuff of Life. And as we celebrate Halloween this week, we're asking you to share your spooky tales, things that scared you as a kid and continue to haunt you today. From Pleasanton, California, "When I was a young child," you write, "I would run to the door and greet my father every night after he would come home from work. One stormy Halloween, he rang the doorbell, and when I went outside to greet him, he jumped out from behind his car in a werewolf mask. Now, every Halloween, I'm a little more careful when I open doors." Tell us your scary story. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.